Welcome to Native Yoga Toddcast. So happy you are here. My goal with this channel is to bring inspirational speakers to the mic in the field of yoga, massage, body work, and beyond. Follow us at Native Yoga and check us out at nativeyogacenter.com. All right, let's begin. Hello, hello, welcome to Native Yoga Toddcast. My name is Todd McLaughlin, and today I have the exciting news to bring to you that you get a chance to meet Cindy Lusk. You can find Cindy on her website, cindylusk.com. You can also find her on Facebook, Cindy Lusk, and you can also find her on Instagram, cindylu108. Links are in the description. Click follow. She is the author of a book called Align and Refine, The Journey of Yoga and Meditation. You can purchase the book on Amazon, in which case I have the link there as well for you to make that super easy. So I really enjoyed this conversation with Cindy because part of her strategy and goal is to try to make yoga philosophy very approachable and easy to understand for the beginner's mind. And she does a great job of this. She's very down to earth. She has a very clear concept of yoga philosophy. She makes it approachable, and I think you're going to love this. She has a very diverse yoga practice background for many years now, and she's studied with many of the greats, and I think you're going to really enjoy hearing some of the insights that she's gleaned over the years of practicing. So let's go ahead and get started. I'm so delighted to have the opportunity to bring Cindy Lusk today onto the podcast. She is the author of Align and Refine, The Journey of Yoga and Meditation. Cindy, thank you so much for joining me. Can you just fill me in a little bit on how your day is going so far? How are you feeling?
Hi, Todd. I'm so glad to be here. I'm having a good day. We've been in a deep freeze here for the last 3-4 days, and I've hardly stepped out of the house. Wow. Except to go shovel snow.
Where are you?
So, it's actually making me really grateful that I've got a nice warm house and all of that going on.
Oh, yeah. Where are you?
I'm in Boulder, Colorado.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Lucky you. I hear it's amazing there. I've never had a chance to go to Boulder, but I just feel like it's the epicenter of yoga, meditation, and everything in between.
Yeah, there's been so much going on here over the years, from Naropa and, you know, all the different yoga and massage schools and, just lots of things like that.
That's cool. Where were you born?
I'm actually from Morgantown, West Virginia.
Cool.
And my dad was in the military, and so we moved around a whole lot.
Yeah, and, I hear you. I believe
including
it.
Including living in Europe for a while.
Wow.
So,
where did you graduate from high school?
In California.
Whoa, what part?
And that set me up to, as an undergraduate, I went to the University of California, Santa Cruz. That's actually where I took my first yoga class.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Santa Cruz. I have been to Santa Cruz. That is another epicenter of great things.
I know. I feel so lucky. I went to undergraduate in Santa Cruz and then graduate school in Boulder.
What was your major and graduate work with?
Psychology, social psychology.
Cool.
I was really fortunate to study with a man named Elliot Aronson, who's one of the top social psychologists at the time anyway. And I had, through the experiences of moving around, been in pretty integrated schools when I was in military schools, like in Europe. And then I got to San Antonio, Texas, and there was a lot, and this was in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s. And actually, we went to Syracuse, New York first, and I was involved in a busing project there. And then when I got into junior high and high school and in Texas. There was just a lot of racial tension and so on. And I was very intrigued by all of that. And that is actually what sent me into studying social psychology, wow, because I wanted to address prejudice and racism.
Yes. Amazing. Yeah. Around during that time and aware of what's going on. That's incredible. I can see how that would push you or nudge you in the direction of how do I start to understand social psychology, the psychology of our society?
Yeah. And it's interesting because I wrote a dissertation on how to change stereotypes and basically found they're very impermeable to change. At the same time, I had started really, really getting into yoga with Richard Freeman.
Wow.
And I although I got a job for a while, related to my PhD, I finally decided that if I really wanted to address some of these social issues, I had to look at people's hearts and minds. That no amount of like evidence on the surface of life changes people that much. So I really wanted to find a modality that penetrated into people's hearts. So that's why I just kind of gave all that up and moved into teaching yoga.
Very cool.
Yeah.
How have you been able to weave your social psychology background into your yoga teaching? Like, what's an example of a way that your curiosity about understanding why humans do what they do in a social setting, how did that shape your yoga teaching?
Well, as I said, I kind of got the sense that we really had to work with people's hearts. And what I found with myself is that the yoga was changing me from the inside out rather than trying to do things from the outside in. All that's important. You know, it's important to have laws and regulations and all of that stuff. But especially as I started studying yoga philosophy, I did see some overlap between what the sages, the ancient sages in the texts were teaching and what I had learned in psychology in general. And, for example, when I got to studying some of the tantras, one of which is the Shiva Sutra, the very first couple aphorisms allude to these mechanisms that the tantras talk about called the malas, which are these obscurations of the heart. The fundamental one is called the anavamala, which is basically a squeeze from a tantric perspective, everything is divine consciousness, but we as individuals get squeezed into this human existence. And so we go from this very omnipresent, elevated consciousness into these human bodies. And it leaves us feeling kind of less than. It leaves us feeling constricted. And from that place of constriction also arises a sense of differentiation, which is another one of the malas, where we see ourselves separate from each other. So that separateness, when I started reading about the Maya Mala, it's called, when I started learning about that, I was like, wow, this is just kind of what I, is an explanation for that sense of in-group and out-group, which was a big topic in social psychology of us and them, and how that can then lead to all of these differentiating and negative behaviors toward one another.
Wow. Beautifully said. That was a good explanation.
Yeah.
That's cool. The us and then them as what being one of the underpinnings of why we can't get along.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And you see it. It's all the so-called tribalism or whatever. It's not the best way to put it, but the different groups, and there's a lot of famous social psychology experiments around, in-group and out-group and so forth. But Yeah.
That's cool. And so you were in Santa Cruz, you took your first yoga class, and then after realizing, wait, I want to work with people on a level where we change from the inside out.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I want to give a shout out. My first yoga teacher was named Ann Barros. She's a very sweet Iyengar teacher who recently passed away. And, you know, I was in college. I was taking all kinds of things, yeah. And yoga was one of them. Being Santa Cruz, you could take yoga for credit there way back in the late 70s. And then I came out here to go to grad school. And what happened was I was in a romantic relationship that just ended abruptly. And I was heartbroken. And I, for some reason, I was called to start looking for a yoga teacher at that time, which, you know, one of the things I take from that as a teacher, a yoga teacher, really any kind of teacher, is that you never know, like Ann Barros planted a seed in me that when the conditions were right, kind of sprouted me to go back to that. Like she probably saw me one semester and then wondered, or never saw me again and thought, oh, well, that's a lost cause. But often we never know when we plant these seeds, how, you know, it's going to impact
good
people's
point.
Lives.
That's a good point.
I found that out. So that led me to search out a teacher who sent me to Richard Freeman.
Nice.
Who is an amazing teacher, as many people know.
He's an amazing teacher. You're right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You went from the Iyengar school to the Ashtanga school. How was that transition for you?
Well, you know, honestly, Richard was teaching more an Iyengar method at the time.
That's right.
And he, it was funny back then, you know, there wasn't the internet or email lists or any of that, you know, it was word of mouth a lot. And a couple of people have said, you really need to, you know, if you want to do yoga, you got to go find Richard. And so the way you found him was through some poster at the health food store or
awesome.
Like that. And
those are the good old days for sure.
Yeah.
Right?
And he was teaching in all these different funky places. And then he would disappear for a while and you'd look for another poster and he'd reappear. And I remember there was a distinct time when he was having a weekend workshop and, you know, all of us showed up and all of a sudden we were like doing these jumpings and I was like, what is this? I remember one of my friends, you know, turned to me like, what the heck is this? And he really brought us along in the primary series, actually, quite quickly in retrospect, because he was really into it. And I think he had gone to a workshop with Pattabhi Joyce at Feathered Pipe.
Mm. And Feathered Pipe is where? Where's Feathered Pipe? Is that?
It's in Montana.
It's Montana. Does that still exist?
Is that still from way back when?
Is that still there? Is Feathered Pipe still there?
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's where he first.
Yeah. And so he came back from that and then he started bringing us through, and then he would go off to India for months at a time to study with Pattabhi Joyce. And eventually, he established a studio. And honestly, I think in part, the reason he established it was because he wanted to host Pattabhi Joyce. In 1989, Pattabhi Joyce came to Boulder and a couple other places. And I think he went to Encinitas. And here in Boulder, he did primary series, and then he was doing intermediate series in Encinitas. And I went out there to do the intermediate series with him. And I think that's when I met Tim Miller.
Nice.
He might have come to Boulder
yeah.
to chauffeur. You know, Pattabhi Joyce to Encinitas, but I'm not sure. I don't really remember.
Yeah.
I got to meet Tim then. It was funny thing. A couple of funny things about that whole situation.
Please tell me.
In Encinitas was, and I think it was Solana Beach was where the studio was. and it was before Tim had his studio. But the first day we all showed up to do intermediate series, and Tim walks in and says, well, Toby Joyce isn't coming today because he's going to get a haircut. And so Tim led us through primary series. And it was funny because half the people couldn't do it. And he just, at the end of class, he says, I don't know why you people are signed up for intermediate series.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And then during the workshop that week, another funny thing that happened was that for some reason, I was still doing headstand at the wall. And I don't know if I just got away with it in Boulder because he'd been in Boulder the previous week. But by the time I got to Encinitas, he was like, no, you're doing it in the center of the room. And so when we got to headstand, he would come and put, you know, help me balance. And then when he got me balanced and everyone else was up in it, he would start his counting and he'd go, one, two. And for several days, he would get to about 20. And I would think, oh my God, I made it. Because he would walk away and I would be balancing and I'd be sitting there, oh my God, I made it. And then I'd fall over. And he would go, oh, bad lady. And he'd come over and get me back up in it. And then he'd start, one, two. And I was just mortified because I thought, oh my God, all other people here.
They're going to throw eggs at my car.
Headstand forever. Oh my God. But by the end of the week, I was doing headstand in the middle of the room by myself.
That's awesome.
Funny.
I love hearing
And the
this.
Other thing about that time is we got to, he was teaching advanced series with Toby Joyce. And so many of us got to observe. We got to see Tim and I think Chuck Miller was there. And
it was
a fun time.
Super fun.
And during that tour, Toby Joyce, told everybody, oh, you come India, you come India. So in 1990, all of us trotted off and that was my first trip to Mysore.
Wow. How was that? What did you think?
You know what? It was really challenging for me on a lot of levels. I mean, India blew my mind.
Yes.
And in 1990, India was a lot different. Traveling in India was a lot different than it is now. I pretty quickly got sick.
Ooh. I might die type. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, the yogic weight loss plan,
weight loss plan. My gosh. So were you able to practice or were you just laid up for how long?
I was out a couple days and I was able to practice, but what was unfortunate was it was not too long after we first got there. And I traveled there with a couple of my girlfriends, Teresa and Annie Pace.
Yeah, we've hosted Annie here at our studio before.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Oh man.
She and I and this other gal traveled there together because we knew each other from here.
Yeah.
And Toby Joyce was hosting students at his house and I was just too sick to go. So I was so disappointed about that. And at that time, I think there was only 12 or 15 of us there. You know, it was very early. It was way before. It was before it exploded.
Yeah.
Because I went back in 94 and there was about 50 people there. And I went back in 96 and there was about 70 or 80 people there.
Yeah.
So
yes.
It got to be quite a machination. But I got sick. I also ripped a hamstring in the infamous Supta Hasta Padangustasana assist.
Ooh. And you're laying on your back. You have your big toe. You're lifting your body. Toby Joyce came over, put his leg or foot on your leg that's on the ground and laid on top of your other leg.
Pushed the other leg to the ground.
Ooh.
And it audibly popped.
Ooh.
And everyone in the room could
Everybody cringed. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next day he was like, oh, you skipped that today. Like he gave me two days of not doing it.
Yeah.
And then it was back to doing
it.
So it was very painful.
That's a rough one.
And I had trouble with the food, the spicy food. But actually I was sad to leave when it was time to go.
Yeah,
it was good for me to leave because I really need to heal my body.
Yeah.
So,
I love hearing.
And I did go, yeah. And I went back.
And you went back, of course, right? Because it's as challenging as it is, it's still somehow so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I decided when I went back, I had to stay another month because honestly, I felt like it took me a month. The other thing I had trouble with was just the time change. I mean, India is 12, you know, it's day is night, night and day with the United States. And so I just really had a hard time just not feeling out of it a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to ask Cindy just because, I mean, I really only want to stay in a realm of positivity and good vibes. And I love hearing all these stories, but how have you processed all of the kind of changes that have occurred over the years and people's feelings about it was too aggressive, I got hurt. You're being very honest, like, look, it was amazing, but I got hurt. I had a great time. I also was really sick. I mean, this is the reality of international travel and or that type of yoga practice. Did you go through any growing pains in the last few years when there was fallout and all that jazz? How did you manage all that?
I had moved on from Ashtanga before the Ashtanga had its fallout.
Yeah.
Because my body couldn't take it. That's basically how it came down to. I also had a chronic low back problem. And one of the beautiful things about Richard is he brought a lot of people into the studio. And one of the people he brought in was John Friend. And so I met John and one of the things I loved about John was he offered teacher trainings. And I did one of his teacher trainings. And one of the gifts that John gave me was he got me out of pain.
Wow.
Like he taught me how to not have my back hurt.
Amazing.
And that was pretty important for me.
Very important. Yeah.
Because I was kind of a little bit at my wit's end because I loved the practice, but it was not working for me anymore, especially as I was getting a little older.
I appreciate your honesty.
So I feel like Anasara yoga saved me and allowed me. And then that had its own trajectory. So
yeah. Fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Because I have my own back problems and I'm learning how to navigate it. Do you know what sort of name the problem would have been given? I have a spondylolisthesis. So my L5 is slipped forward and I ruptured in between S1, L5. So my back bending game is just like a totally different, experience these days. I bridge at the most and I'm just Urdhva Dhanurasana. And I'm like, no. And so many yoga people are like, oh, back bending will fix your back. It's so good. I'm like, I know, but I'm trying to tell you, man, it's not that simple in my situation, or maybe it is. And maybe some light will shine and I'll go, oh, and I figure something out. But I just would love to hear what you learned, because I'm learning so much by talking to other people.
It was, I actually, the only diagnosis I really got was that I had really severe disc damage in those lower discs. And the way I could work with it is, first of all, backing off and not trying to grab my ankles in Urdhva Dhanurasana, which is just really not in the range of motion of many people. And back bends were always super challenging to me. I could whip my foot behind my head, stand up and do all that kind of stuff. The forward bending was my thing, putting both feet behind my head and that kind of stuff. But the back bending just didn't work for me. And so for me, it was really backing off, really learning how to work my feet and my legs very strongly. And then, for me to do the back bends with Batabi Joyce pulling my hands to my ankles, I was like splaying my legs out, shoving my coccyx up and, just crunching the lower vertebra. So I just really had to not let my legs splay and, you know, work my legs and my feet and keep from really pushing my groins forward and, excellent, you know, backing off and slowing it down.
Yeah. Cool. Well, then did you then choose not to go practice with Batabi Joyce because you were fearful of the fact that he would say,
I just slowly transitioned from Ashtanga to Anusara.
Got it.
And I became an Anusara certified teacher and taught that. But the Ashtanga, I really consider it my root, you know, my home in many ways. I personally don't think that the series are necessarily the most intelligent sequences. And I certainly think that the range of motion required for many of the postures is not possible for many bodies. And, you know, my sense of it is it was developed on, you know, young boys. Mm-hmm. So, you know, women in their 50s and 60s, maybe it's not the best thing for
I hear you. Well, I appreciate you laying all that out because it's so important, I think, to acknowledge the reality of all of this. It's excellent. Yeah. So then,
what I love about Ashtanga, which is what I wanted to say, was I love the emphasis on the breath and of the drishti and just the beautiful thing that Anusara gave me is a disciplined practice, you know, and showing up on the mat. And I took this into my meditation practice when I finally started meditating and just doing it. You know, you do. It's all practice, you know, 90% practice or whatever the the adage is. Yeah. But that was a gift because it taught me a certain discipline and to just show up whether or not how I'm feeling or whatever happens on the mat or the cushion that day, that's all good. You just do it. And that's a beautiful thing. And still, you know, now I'm teaching, you know, kind of my own thing, kind of alignment based vinyasa, I would say. I always start with the breath, you know, just emphasizing the breath and coordinating movement with breath.
Yes.
Because I feel like for people who are just asana students and maybe not meditate, that allows them some access to a little slightly deeper, more subtle place within themselves. And it starts kind of that inward trajectory.
Yes. Are you currently making a living as a yoga teacher?
Well, I'm semi-retired, I would say.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm teaching 4 yoga classes via Zoom a week, and I teach meditation.
Nice.
So, you know, that's one of the things that I always felt like in the Ashtanga system, you know, where does meditation come in? After you learn third series in pranayama, I'm not, you know, it's, I felt like it needed to be integrated in because when I started studying yoga philosophy, like when I read Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, sort of like it was all about meditation, really. It had nothing, very little to do with what I was doing on the mat. And then when I got into Anusara, I felt like that there was this presumption that you were meditating, but there wasn't really a method given. I had in Mysore, I had hooked up with a teacher at the Sanskrit college to study the Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita and other texts with. And he had taught some meditation. And but his only instruction was clear your mind. It just didn't really work. And I basically thought is no good at meditating or is a bad meditator or something of that ilk. But one of the beautiful things about John Friend is he also brought a lot of amazing people into his workshops. And one of the people he brought in, one of them was Douglas Brooks, who I studied with quite a lot, and Sally Kempton, beautiful being who also recently passed, and you know, Bill Mahoney brought in, but he also brought in Paul Mulhortega. And from Paul, I learned meditation. And he also, after he has a meditation school called Nilakanta Meditation. And after many years of kind of bringing up a bunch of students, he started training us to teach meditation as well. And
cool.
I teach that as well.
Nice. Well, that's awesome. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, a whole lot of things. And I talk about this a bit in the book. I integrate some of these stories that I'm telling now. But, you know, when I was at the yoga workshop, I started, you know, there were times when I would have some experiences in the asana practice of feeling kind of a witness consciousness emerge. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about that practice is, again, that focused will take you internally on the breath if you let it. And I was really curious about what was happening. And so I sought to study yoga philosophy, and I was so confused by it because it seemed, first of all, to have little to do with what I was doing in my yoga practice. And second, it was impenetrable. You know, back then there weren't a lot of translations out. Invariably you were pointed to the Yoga Sutra, and most of the translations were extremely academic. And it was just very confusing to me, like being in India and all the gods and goddesses and then the swamis and just trying to put all that together. And so I put myself on a path of serious study of philosophy, and the form that took a lot was just putting it out there. I'm going to teach a class on the Yoga Sutra. And people came to my living room and we, you know, I was like maybe one step ahead of the students, and we just worked on it. And I started getting invited to come into teacher trainings to teach philosophy and that sort of thing. And in one of those trainings, I wrote a diagram on the wall, or on the, you know, a whiteboard. And I realized, wow, this is a really succinct, nice summary of the teachings. And it was an amalgamation of both classical yoga and tantra, which is kind of where Anasara and Nilakanta meditation are associated with. And I realized it was a book, and I realized that it could be of great service to write the book that I wish I had had when I first started exploring yoga philosophy, to honor the texts. So in the book, I give actual aphorisms and translations of aphorisms, but then I really try to explain them in a very accessible way that makes sense to a modern day practitioner, as well as I include a lot of exercises to make them applicable to your life.
Nice.
So yeah, it's basically the book I wanted.
That's great. How long did it take you to put it together from the moment you said, okay, this is what I'm going to do, to this moment where it's actually published and available for me to go to Amazon and click and it arrives at my door?
It was probably 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
I would say. Yeah.
And because
what I learned is that a book has a life of its own. And it took me a while. It was hard for me to figure out how to order it, for one thing. I had all the pieces, but how to make it flow was a little harder to figure out, and how to address some of the issues like highest consciousness. Like, what is highest consciousness, and trying to explain that.
Good point. So. Can you help us out a little with understanding the intersection points of the yoga philosophy, or the philosophy of the Yoga Sutras, and such as a text like the Shiva Sutra, which is a tantric text, and Then we hear there's the renunciate path, such as the Yoga Sutras might kind of cater to the monk, the nun, the renunciate, and the Tantra path, perhaps helping the householder. Can you touch upon a few points where they intersect and seem to have the same philosophy, and some of the points where they are really different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's a big question.
It is a big question. How much time do we have? Okay. All right.
But I address all of this in the book.
Wonderful.
And in short, this is what was so perplexing to me in the beginning, because the Yoga Sutra, you know, classical yoga, Patanjali's text, is clearly a renunciate text. And I went around to every teacher who I could, and the teacher that actually sent me to Richard, we would sit around after class, and I would ask him, it's like, I don't really understand. It's like, if we're here in this world in these bodies, then why is it trying to teach us to subjugate the bodies? You know, it's like, I really, really, it just didn't resonate to me. And that's why I was very happy to find the tantric path. But the tantras assume that they kind of take the Yoga Sutra and classical yoga for granted, and they build on it. So they don't completely negate it. But, and this is kind of the history of philosophy in general in yoga, is that it's a progression. And this is what's kind of confusing about it, is there'll be, you know, a particular school, and then someone else will come along and say, well, this is what they got right, and this is what they got wrong, and so I'm going to make this other school. And then the next people come along. So what Tantra adds to classical yoga is this idea of a higher consciousness, because the Yoga Sutra has this concept, kind of mysterious concept, of Ishvara, but they really don't want to go to the place of saying that there is a higher consciousness. A Yoga Sutra really is a dualist text, in that it says there is this separation between matter and spirit, whereas in the tantric non-dual schools, they say that everything is a manifestation of the divine. So all of humans are as well manifestations of the divine. And the idea is that the path of yoga can actually help you amplify your life as a householder. And this is something that's been mixed up a lot, where renunciate practices are given to householders, and it can actually kind of block them. Whereas if you're doing instead a practice intended for householders, the idea is that it supports your life.
Yes. Good point.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's a big, I don't want to say mistake, because I mean, there is really no mistake if we're learning, but do you feel like that's a potential mistake as a new yoga?
I mean, I remember sitting around in Mysore with having conversations with other students about, you know, what you can eat and what you can do. And, you know, a lot of there was a real renunciate thrust, I felt, in the community to some degree. And so I just think it gives a lot of confusion in general in the yoga world, when what is mostly taught in teacher trainings is the Yoga Sutra, which has that flavor of negating. You know, a great metaphor is one of the ocean and the wave, where the ocean is consciousness, and you know, we are each individuals who rise out of that ocean. And in classical yoga or renunciate persuasions, the idea is to flatten your wave back into the ocean. Whereas in a tantric perspective, the idea is to amplify your life wave, to draw on the power of the ocean, the power of the higher consciousness to really live your life in the fullest possible way.
That's cool.
And, you know, that's where I end the book with in terms of coming back full circle to the social psychology that I was in. The very last chapter of the book is called Change Consciousness, Change the World. Because I feel that as we each work on ourselves in these ways, it has this ripple out effect. And we all know this. I mean, that's why we want to hang out with certain people. That's why Richard's classes, you couldn't even hardly get in, you know, the door. There were so many people there because certain people have a vibe that, you know, that you can pick up on. And so each of us as yogis can create via our practices a connection with our hearts, and that's going to ripple out into the world. It's going to help us as individuals make the choices in our lives that is most beneficial for ourselves and the world at large as well. But collectively, when, you know, there's a mass of us that are starting to really connect to our hearts and live in ways that are aligned with the highest, that's going to slowly start shifting things on the planet.
Good point. Can you speak a little bit about your original intention to help change racism? You're witnessing late 60s, early 70s culture and what was going on. Can you explain a little bit about the transformation of consciousness that can occur from someone being racist to not being racist?
Oh boy, that's a big question. You know, I think each of us, I know with a lot of the current events that have happened, even though I was well aware of the literature in social psychology, as well as the yoga philosophy, I personally had to and still have to look at, I think we each have to look in ourselves and understand our unconscious biases, first of all, and as well, be honest about the structural aspects in our society.
Yeah.
So that's yes. One level that we really, you know,
yeah.
That really needs to be addressed.
Good point.
So I don't want want anyone to think, oh, if we all just get connected with our hearts, you know, there won't be any racism, because it's out there. And so the as I said before, the work I had done in graduate school convinced me that we really had to work at a deeper level as individuals. So to the degree people are willing to do that, it will shift things.
Yes.
Not everybody wants to go there. So things get perpetuated. And that's why we really have to look at, you know, I feel like we have to work at all levels to effect change.
Good answer. Great point. So
yeah, because I don't want to go into, you know, this so-called spiritual bypassing situation.
Good point.
Yeah.
When you say you have a new student, imagine I'm a brand new student and I've never picked up a yoga book. I've seen a yoga sign on a building, like I drove by, saw a sign. That's as far as I've taken it. And I drop in on your meditation class. Mm-hmm. At what junction do you want to enter me? Like, what are you going to take me down a little bit of yoga sutra philosophy just to kind of prime a little historical understanding of an evolution from this philosophy and the what Tantra brought to these classical philosophies to bring it a little bit more appropriate for humanity. Where would you want to start me? Like, what idea or concept do you think? And I guess it's not a real world situation. You're not. I have had a little bit of study, so. But if you could imagine I was just a brand new practitioner, where would you start me?
Well, usually when someone approaches me about meditation, I ask them why they're interested in meditation. So, I mean, that's kind of a segue in.
That's cool.
Because if someone, you know, sees a sign and they open the door, it means that there's something of interest to them. And, you know, in the yoga philosophy parlance, that can be related to adhikara, you know, your readiness to pursue something. So the fact that someone asked the question, you know, means that there's something inside them that is wanting something more. And then, you know, the way Nilakanta meditation works is it's a one-on-one thing where you sit down and you do talk a little bit about these issues that we've been talking about, like what does Yoga Sutra teach us about meditation, and then what does Tantra, you know, add on to that. And then you learn the practice and how to do it. And the way I teach meditation is one-on-one and small groups. Mm-hmm. But nice. I don't have meditation classes. I have a class where I call it the full circle class, where we do like 45 minutes of asana, and then we sit down and we do pranayama and some chanting, and then we meditate together as a group. It's a very beautiful format. It's not for very many people, but
nice.
Yeah. I don't teach meditation. We just sit together.
The part that wouldn't be for many people is because it's so, it would take so much time. Like when you say,
no, we do it in an hour and a half.
Okay.
So it's not too bad, but
it's not too physically.
Most people don't want, you know, there's not a lot of yoga. Asana students who meditate.
Yeah. It's true, isn't it?
I mean, that's just how it is. The truth.
Yeah. Do you think that scale will ever tip?
Well, there's a lot of people who meditate and don't do yoga asana too.
That's true.
I used to have arguments all the time with one of my teachers about, you know, the superficiality of yoga asana and you know, blah, blah, blah. I always said, it's a doorway. You know, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for yoga asana. I think for many people, it's a way that they can, in our modern society, that they can move their body and move energy and find a little bit of peace of mind. And I think once people get a taste of that, then many, many people are called to, you know, some of the other aspects of yoga.
Very cool. When you sit down for meditation, obviously you made mention that you follow a tradition or a style of practice called Nilakanta. Mm-hmm. Is there a certain technique there? How much does that technique weave in chakra philosophy?
It doesn't really. I mean, it directly. It's a mantra-based meditation, and really the work with the chakras would happen kind of as a result of doing the meditation rather than trying to mess directly with the chakras, if that makes sense.
It does. Understand.
And that's one of the points actually that I make in the book is, and that I learned from my teacher, Pablo Ortega, is that when we regularly meditate and we take our awareness into these deeper spaces of awareness, a lot of things happen. And that's where some of the teachings of the Yoga Sutra come in, because the Yoga Sutra explains how the samskaras, you know, the chitta-vrittis are brought to quiet by the kind of the burning up of this, all this samskaric residue that's within us, and, you know, addressing the kleshas and all of that that is in the Yoga Sutra. And when your awareness starts to become clearer because of repeated, you know, burning up of samskaras and the attenuating of the kleshas, then other things naturally happen from the inside out rather than from the outside in, if that makes sense. So the chakras will start opening up, and that's, you know, when you might have the kundalini experiences naturally, because that's been clarified and the subtle body is ready for it.
How would you explain your own personal kundalini experiences that you've had?
Well, I think, you know, within the realm of meditation, people can have all kinds of experiences. And that's not really what we're after. We're after actually higher states of consciousness. We want to stabilize in states of consciousness that allow us to be centered and clear and to start recognizing in ourselves our own divinity, and allow us to then also recognize that in everybody else. And again, getting back to the change consciousness, change the world, when we can recognize the divinity in everything, it leads us to treating each other as divine beings and the planet as well. So the thing is because we all have a different samskaric patterning. Paul Malortega calls it the prior originating matrix that we have. All of our experiences, whether it's the experience in meditation or how we interact with the world, are kind of filtered through our unique, you know, kind of samskaric patterning. And so I think all kinds of different experiences can happen for different people.
Yeah. Good answer. That's a hard one to answer, I think.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, what's tricky about teaching meditation in particular is that you, as a guide, you want to kind of let people know what to expect, but you don't want to set up expectations.
That is a conundrum.
Yeah, it really is.
Be aware of this pitfall up ahead. What pitfall? Oh my gosh, I'm falling into that pit right now. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Good point.
And that's one of the beautiful things. And this is so different from Patabi Joyce. You know, Patabi Joyce was really all about practice, no theory. And so, you know, one of the things that I appreciated about Tantra and this method of meditation that I'm involved in is that we always teach theory and practice simultaneously, so that you understand what's happening and why you're doing something, not just do it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me too. Do you think sometimes I came across that I used to one of my first yoga teachers that I Bikram Chowdhury. Not a really nice man, and not very nice, pretty intense. Good yoga teacher, but not morally good yoga teacher. But anyway, and people would ask questions, and he'd be like, look, you guys are so stupid. You're not going to understand the theory. Just do the practice. So when I heard that, I was like, didn't settle with me well. I was just kind of thought, That's a really bad answer to give. Like, why not give us a little bit of something? Like, give us some theory behind why we're doing what we're doing instead of like, don't even ask. You're not even smart enough to know if I tell you, you're not going to be able to hear. I tell you to straighten your leg. You can't even straighten your leg. So what's your problem? Just focus on straightening your leg. Do you think?
Yeah. Well, that kind of comes back to this idea of adhikara. I mean, he's saying you're not ready to receive the, you won't understand this.
Yeah.
And another thing that came out of the Tantra, especially the teachings of this wonderful sage named Abhinavagupta, is this concept of vikalpa samskara. And
vikalpa samskara.
And the idea is that when you first, and what it means is refinement of understanding. And also refinement of your consciousness. So when you first encounter a teaching, in fact, you may not get very much of it.
True.
But as you work with the concept, then it starts opening up for you. Simultaneously, if you're meditating, your awareness itself is getting clarified. So that anything you place into, you know, any teaching or information that you place into that awareness is more readily understood.
Mm.
So it's a progression of understanding over time. And, you know, that gets to the notion as well, a tantric notion of upaya, which is means, you know, the correct means. And so really, as a teacher, you kind of have to be able to meet your student where they're at with the correct methodology.
Yes.
So, you know, and there's a way you explain things to beginners versus other people.
Yes. You know? Yeah. Man, that is so fascinating. What type of response have you gotten from your book? Like, have you had anybody come back yet and say, oh, this is good? Or maybe negative criticism, like, I don't like it. Have you had any feedback that's...
Well, I developed... The book came out of many courses that I taught. So I had been teaching courses on yoga philosophy for many years. They took, you know, sometimes I would teach about a text and... then I started teaching things like I taught something called the wheel of yoga and then something, the year of yoga, where I was really developing the book, like pulling out, you know, just kind of making sense of it myself. And I got a very good response from it, which was supportive of me writing the book. I did a, you know, kind of a beta test of the book with a course. And I do have a study group on Facebook. I might take it to Substack. I'm debating on this, where we'll have kind of a book discussion.
Cool.
So mostly, you know, the feedback I do get from people is that they're appreciative of me really bringing the authentic teachings into play, but also making them accessible and applicable.
Nice.
And so far I've gotten good reviews. I'll be honest and say I've been scared to put it out there because, you know, you're really subject to criticism.
Yeah.
And one of the points I make in the introduction of the book is I'm not a Sanskrit scholar. I've studied a lot of Sanskrit, but, you know, I've provided my own translations and I'm sure there are errors and, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of places people could say I haven't treated particular topics appropriately, but swaha, it's my offering and
that's
the best
awesome
I could do at the time. And hopefully it will be a benefit for people.
Well, that's amazing. That is a big turning point to actually be like, oh my gosh, I've written this. But am I really wanting to put myself in that place of potential criticism and then just saying, yes, I'm ready. I feel good about this. I feel like this is a reflection of my life, my study, my everything that I'm about, what I'm interested in. So I'm so glad you did. That's awesome. I applaud you. I have fancies and dream or fantasies of writing a book, and then I just go, wow, where do I start? So just the fact that you like followed through. I'm asking this question tongue in cheek. I know we have just a couple more minutes here. How much of ChatGPT did you use to write the book?
Absolutely none.
Well done. You know, the more I interact with AI, I feel like writing eventually is going to have to come to a point where, just like when we go to the grocery store and we choose either chemically grown food or non-GMO food or organic food, and that at some point we're gonna need to like pass a test saying this was a human written book versus this is an AI written book, and then we can choose, okay, I want to read what a human wrote, or I want to read what the internet wrote, or an artificial bot. So that's pretty cool. I think that's worth bringing attention to, that you wrote this yourself out of your own brain, mind, experience, which I still value. I really like the AI thing, so I'm not poo-pooing it, but I think
there's some good things that it can be utilized for.
But I think what you did
maybe
is,
even writing books, I don't know, but AI wasn't around when I was, you know, ChatGPT wasn't available when I was writing this. And I did follow a process that I actually do outline in the book of where you put a teaching into your awareness, you know, you meditate a little bit, you put a teaching into your awareness, and then you write about it. Because there's something about letting it percolate deeper in your awareness rather than using your analytic mind about it, and then letting your awareness stream out through your hands onto a piece of paper or onto a computer. That it's a, you know, it allows you to get to a deeper, you know, understanding beyond kind of an intellectual understanding. And then when you have to articulate it, it even makes it more real.
Nice. I wonder if you were to say you were to come here and teach a workshop, a weekend workshop, would you focus on writing prompts with students? Like, have you led a workshop setting where you introduce a philosophical idea and then say, okay, I want you all to write, and then have people share it? What type of structure have you?
Yeah, I mean, often that's what I have done in my workshops and in my courses in particular, where we, you know, take a teaching and we do just that. We read about it. We, you know, we do the intellectual work of understanding on an intellectual level, but then you sit back and you just kind of, it's a, you know, it's like a contemplative practice. It's called bhavana. And so you just allow, again, I already explained it, but
that's cool.
It's a way for people to make the teachings their own.
Yes. Oh, I like it.
Yeah.
Wow, Cindy, this has been such a treat. I am so thankful to have this opportunity to meet you and to speak with you. All the links for everything is here. So for you listening, just click below and you can find Cindy, her website, cindyluska.com. You can find a link on Amazon to purchase the book. Can they reach out to you, Cindy, via your website on an email if they have questions, if we have questions?
There's a contact on my my website for sure.
Nice. Is there anything else you would like to add in closing for our session today that you want to share?
Well, just, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I wanted to really make an argument for why meditation can be a beautiful practice. And I think many people feel that this is that it somehow takes away from life and it requires some major effort, when it can actually be easily introduced into your life and can have profound effects. And so I just encourage everybody to, you know, consider integrating meditation into their lives.
Yes. Oh, man. Thank you so much, Cindy. I really appreciate this opportunity. And I look forward to hopefully meeting you in person, although this computer thing is pretty cool that you're in Colorado and freezing freezing temperatures. I'm here in Florida and I'm sweating. And and here we are. It's awesome. We transcended space and time for a few moments. And
thank you so much. It's been a delight to.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to meeting you in the future in person. Native Yoga Toddcast is produced by myself. The theme music is dreamed up by Bryce Allen. If you like this show, let me know. If there's room for improvement, I want to hear that too. We are curious to know what you think and what you want more of, what I can improve. And if you have ideas for future guests or topics, please send us your thoughts to info@nativeyogacenter.com. You can find us at nativeyogacenter.com. And hey, if you did like this episode, share it with your friends, rate it and review, and join us next time.